So I was asked to worship in from a slide, the main slide, that one, and at the end, just in case you're wondering about resources, that one, and then there's a trailer about questions. So very simple, and other than that, I'll just be talking with you, which is usually the way I work, with a very minimum of slides. So my background: I used to work for Marsh Gold from 2001 to 2007, and since then I've got my own business, which I run myself in Brisbane, Queensland. And before I came to Australia, I ran my own business, and I didn't have a clue. And that was in the Netherlands in the early 90s. And before that, I was a high school dropout. So LCAs are actually pretty much the only time of year that I actually get to see university on the inside, because I never was here. So it's cool to actually hang out at colleges and do that kind of stuff. I sometimes teach training courses at the University of Queensland, but traveling around is quite a good fun. So what I'd like to look at now is what happens when you make certain decisions in a business, and even if you apply proven business practices, talk about what the consequences actually are in the real world, and how that might affect the viability of your business or the direction that your business takes. Because the way I have found, your choices are not quite as wide as you think, but that mainly depends on the choices you've made before. If you can't continually backtrack, that gets very expensive at some point, or it could get very expensive. So, a business plan. How many of you here have set up your own business? Okay. How many of you here have actually made a business plan for that? Okay. Does someone want to fess up why you made the business plan?
Yes.
What was the specific purpose of the business plan?
To see if it would make money.
Okay. Just for yourself?
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, that's a good one. Yeah. Anyone else?
To give a structure of how we're going to do what we're going to do, because we do the right things.
For organization reasons, just to prove for yourself that the business model might work. Yeah. Luckily, I haven't heard the to get money from the bank answer, because that is one of the main original reasons that people wrote business plans, and it tends to be a thick stack of paper. If you write a business plan, you go to the bank, you get your credit and your funding, and then the big stack of business papers gets shelved and you never look at it again, which is kind of entertaining, but I don't know how much time has gone into actually writing that. It's probably a bit of a waste. So I do believe in thinking about your business, and yes, you could do that by writing down or scribbling a lot of information on the whiteboard and then copying the result once you're actually satisfied with the result. Bouncing ideas of friends, things like that. But what you originally set out to do with your business is probably not what you end up doing. So if you write your business plan with a 5-year plan, that's wonderful, but just expect it to be garbage by next month. Because the moment you hit the real market and you get your real customers or potential customers, you will be doing something else. Or you will be making money. In case of open source in particular, you might actually be making money in a completely different way to what you were thinking. You might still be in the same space, but in fact you're doing something slightly different. To put that example with my own company, so I teach MySQL training courses, or mainly MySQL training courses and other consulting. And some months I think I'm mostly a consulting company, and some months I think I'm actually mostly a training company. It varies, and I couldn't have envisioned that beforehand. I didn't have a clue about that, because in both cases, the way I've structured what I'm offering to my clients had not been done by other businesses in exactly that way. So I had no example to go on. Both the pricing and the exact offering are slightly different from what I was doing. So that's an interesting thing there. So funding. Where wants to tell how they funded their respective businesses? How do you put your money in? Do you put any money in?
Do
you need to put any money in. Anyone?
So.
Yeah?
So fun.
Any ballpark?
Very cheap to get started.
Okay.
Just
a couple of hundred, a couple of thousand?
Yeah, less than 10,000.
Okay. Yeah. Anyone else? Over there?
I don't know.
Yeah?
About like 3,000.
Okay. Yeah.
Myself.
Yeah. I think Open Career was in the realm. Couple of thousand dollars, but I needed some stuff and I needed a new laptop. yep, in the back. No? Oh, so you should tap with your hand. Okay. Yeah, so I think that one is really important, and we'll get to venture capital in a moment. So what happens when you do get money from the bank? Any thoughts on what the consequences are of making a choice to actually get a significant amount of money from an investor?
They actually expect you to pay them back.
Yeah, it's bummer that. Yeah. So if your business is a dismal failure, you've got a real problem, personally and with your family, but you can create all kind of legal structures to kind of evade that, but they cost money and time as well, and it's kind of gets worse from there. So venture capital is particularly interesting, and I've been watching basically the Web 2.0 space and the nifty ideas that people come up with and then build a website around that. What I'm generally wondering is, okay, so you've got this nifty idea, but do you actually have a product or service you're selling? And the common answer is no, absolutely not. Facebook might be an interesting example of how something that doesn't quite fit into a product or service category kind of lives quite happily at the moment. But most of those businesses I've seen that actually do make money through advertising. They put on ads. Anyone have any thoughts on what that might mean?
There's a weakness in there, because if people start to come on the AdBlock Plus or something like that,
yes.
Where does that lead that business from?
Like at the current time. Even a company like Google, a couple of years ago, they used to run on 70% ad income. At the moment, I understand, it's 97% ad income. That means that reduction in ad income is very significant to their business. But for Google, it is actually their business to do ads. For those other businesses, it's kind of a sideline. They operate similar to, television network. The customers of a television network are not the viewers, they're the advertisers. So they need to get viewers to get the advertisers, but the two are not directly connected. In fact, they're kind of opposed, because many of the viewers don't actually want advertisements. So they prefer them to not be there. It's a bit of a complication. Yeah, question there?
The other thing with it is that during times of financial crisis, etc., the thing that begins to cut in the business is ads.
Hmm. Exactly. So the way I describe it is advertising, it may be a valid thing that you could do on the side, but it's a revenue stream and not a business model. Advertising can't possibly be a business model. Unless maybe you're Google, but still, they have a problem now, because so much of their business is related to advertising. I don't know how much they're losing at the moment, or how much less they're making. I mean, they might not be losing anything yet, but who knows what's all going on there. That's advertising. Now, venture capital, I found particularly interesting because lots of businesses with nifty ideas, particularly in the Web 2.0 space, if you're based in or moving to, for instance, Silicon Valley, there's been an abundance of money about, even if you don't have a business model yet. So you're basically getting funding for the possibility of your idea developing into something more, or getting sold. That's one of the exit strategies, selling yourself to another business, or floating on the stock market or on NASDAQ, which is the other main strategy. Yes?
I have a question about your statement there that advertising isn't a business model.
Yes, it depends on the business, but as a general, yeah.
Because before I took my current job, I worked for magazines and websites where advertising was primarily what supported the business. So
yes.
Could you explain what you mean there?
Those advertisements are not actually Well, let me put it this way. The service or product that you're making and selling, offering to your clients, the people that get stuff from you or a service, that's not the same people that do the advertising.
Right.
And that makes for a triangle in relationships rather than a simple customer supplier kind of relationships.
Right.
If I were to sell some kind of hardware or build hardware, as the previous speaker does, you buy stuff upstream, you add value, and you sell it to your clients. With advertising, the story is completely different. You kind of have this sideline that provides a revenue stream, but in fact has nothing to do with your business.
I guess it's
it doesn't add value to your business, to your client, adding those ads to a magazine.
You're really manufacturing attention if you're working in publishing. What you're doing is you're buying, manufacturing that into attention and selling that to someone.
Yes, but you'll agree with me that many, in many cases, the people viewing those ads don't really want to see the ads in the first place. They're actually looking for something else.
True.
For a magazine, they're actually interested in the content of the magazine. And some people, of course, you browse the advertisements sometimes, depending on what kind of magazine or what kind of ads they are. But fundamentally, you're not interested in the ads. It's a necessary evil sideline of whatever else you do. So I would say it's not really, well, in the case of magazines, it may be a necessity in your business model, but it's not fundamentally what you do. If you're building an example from a couple of years back, who remembers Friendster? Yeah? Facebook before Facebook, and Friendster wasn't even the first one yet. There was 6 Degrees in the late 90s. Now, Friendster, of course, had its day, but never actually worked out the business model as far as I can tell. And more and more money kept getting poured in. New funding rounds came in. And in the end, their main revenue stream was advertising. They started adding ads on their pages. That's a real problem because they were losing critical mass. So they had fewer and fewer users on their site. So their revenue stream was going down. That's not a very good thing. And since there's no direct correlation between offering better ads and getting more users,
right,
you lose. They had to offer something else. They had to produce something else, and the ad revenue was kind of an indirect side effect. I think it's sometimes valid to use as a bit in the business, but I don't think it should be the main business focus. I mean, that Friendster was not in the business of selling ads. There was also a network of sites. With nothing to do with that at all. They were providing a service for people to interact with each other. And it would have been really nice if they had found a way to actually monetize that rather than make use of the critical mass, because you can lose your critical mass and still actually provide a valid service. In fact, losing their critical mass was inevitable, you could say, with hindsight. And the same problem might apply to Facebook. They may have been smarter, learning from the previous attempts, but they too will face similar issues. And so, but they do ads, but I think they're making money off more things. I'm not certain. I haven't looked deeply into that one. I just know the Friendster example, where they didn't have any other form of income, which I think is a serious problem. But I'd like to move on for, yeah?
Very quickly, I guess that the two models that we're talking about is telephone directory versus, say, like TV advertising. In other words,
yeah,
you go to a telephone directory to see ads. You're looking for something.
Yes.
You watch TV not to see the ads, but to see the programs.
Yes, exactly. In the case of television network, you very specifically, a viewer is not a client. The viewer is the advertiser. And the problem there becomes that the programs get geared to maximizing the income. Maximizing the income is defined by the advertising. So your program will develop into whatever makes advertisers advertise more, which is getting more viewers. Now, how do you get more viewers in a television program? You lower the quality just a teensy bit, and then you reach more people. At some point you start losing people at the top because it drops too low, but you can drop pretty low before that happens. And whether you're in the US watching television or in Australia watching Channel 10, you know exactly what I mean there. And in the case of Australia, Big Brother sank extremely low, so low that even Pamela Anderson couldn't save it anymore. And it can, but it sank and sank and sank because it was trying to reach more and more people by lowering the quality of the program, essentially. It's the lowest common denominator. And yeah, that doesn't make for good television programs, but it does make for maximum ad revenue. Well, I think we'd like quality television programming, not maximum ad revenue. That's at least my objective as a TV viewer. So I have a Mythbox and I don't actually see ads. And if I zap, I zap my own programs rather than what's actually being broadcast. But there's many things that I would like to see that are not on there at all. So you can find other ways to get that, which is not watch television, get a good book off a walk. That's an interesting thought as well. Anyway, I'd like to get to the venture capital. So who knows here how much money a VC generally wants back?
10 times.
Exactly. That's the idea. They want 10 times their money back. And how long are they willing to wait for that?
3 years.
That's very short. But yes, it happens. It depends a bit.
Some of them say one.
Yeah, that's what they ideally want. Yeah, so it might be 5, but then they get a bit of...
That's when they replace the management team.
Yep. Which usually doesn't
not
work
that
out.
I know, mind you.
There is that, yes. Exactly. They want their money back, and they want their money back fairly quickly. So in 3 to 5 years, you have to grow, provided you're already making a profit, you actually have to grow your business to make 10 times as much money, plus some extra, because you need to grow your business, that will cost money, you'll need to pay people. So that 10 times is extra. Whatever money they put in, you need to pay them back, plus you need to run your business as usual. See, there's a, I don't know, not to be unkind here, but a giant extortion racket would probably be cheaper. Because, yes, it will help you with your business originally, in the case of the VC, but you have to pay them back an extraordinary amount of money. There are usually two ways to get there, and that is going to the stock market or selling your business for an extraordinary amount of money based on prediction of future profitability. And for many businesses, that just doesn't apply.
I mean, surely the real question with whether you go with venture capital or not is what you want to achieve out of, say, a business. If you're doing it for the long term to kind of manage it yourself, then venture capital is a bad way to go, because you'll more than likely not have any control or not have any ownership of the thing after a while. But if you have an idea and you want that idea to have the maximum impact, you want to get going with lots of money at the beginning, then maybe venture capital is the right way to go. It really just depends on what you're trying to achieve.
It may be, but it depends. I do think it also depends on what else you want to do with that idea. But we'll get to that in a moment. So the other thing is, so VC wants back 10 times what they put in. I would say that they'd like more than that. 20 times would be nice, but anyway, 10 is what they go for. So in order to just break even, they're actually, if they're investing in you and 9 other companies, they're actually betting on the fact that 9 of them will fail. I don't like those odds. They're actually betting on me failing. Right? They're hedging their bet. And that doesn't, from my perspective, that's actually not a very nice perspective. They're actually really betting on me failing and 9 others, and then the 10th one might win. I might be the 10th, and then 9 others will feel dismal. It's not really a very nice thing. Now, it might be less than 10, but you get the idea. They're really betting on something very nasty. But the thing that happens once you stick money like that in, you need to give them back that much money, your growth trajectory changes, or the necessary growth trajectory. You need to make a lot more money in a lot less time. So how do you do that? Well, you might hire salespeople. If you've already developed a product, hiring more salespeople in different places might actually make some sense. The moment you hire a salesperson, a specific salesperson rather than a sales skill, which you might have yourself. Every business, of course, needs sales skills, but it's not quite the same thing as hiring specialized sales people. Hiring a salesperson actually ups the cost of the product because the salesperson needs to be paid. You don't have to see it that way, but essentially that's the way it works. And of course, a highly effective salesperson is rather expensive, and they will up the price of the product. So even before you've sold a single item after hiring, your product has already become more expensive, which means you've floated up market, because if you had a fairly low-cost product, you're now no longer a low-cost product, and you will have to address a different market. And it kind of escalates from there. And I've seen this happen to MySQL, and at first MySQL sold support with yearly contracts. And now there is MySQL Enterprise subscriptions sold to you by kind salespeople. And they tend to not talk to you if you're doing less business with them than $50,000 or $100,000. That's a lot of money. And many users are not actually in that space. Never mind whether or not you want to call it enterprise, that's just really a label. You don't have that amount of money to spend or interested in particular service that you get for that amount of money. And that's a significant problem because they've floated upwards to actually make enough money. Now, how does that work? Imagine you're a salesperson and on a very small scale, and you need to make $100,000 in a couple of months. You need to create that much revenue for the business. So if you need to make $100,000 in a couple of months, can you talk with customers that give you $100? You can't, because you're really spending a lot of time then on that $100, or at least spending any time is already wasteful in this case, because you have to make that $99,900 again. You can't even talk to a $1,000 customer. You will have to start talking to $10,000 customers. It's as simple as that. Whether you like that or not, that is the way that salesperson, or you, if you address the market from that perspective, that's the way you'll have to address, because chasing 10 leads is significant, and it might take some time for actually to sign up. And of course, the more expensive you make things, the longer it takes to sign up. So if you're doing that kind of approach, you're kind of floating up market, and the moment you start floating up market, you will keep floating up market. Provide additional value, you up the cost, other sales tactics and more expensive strategies, obviously. The more expensive the product, the more expensive usually it is to sell that particular product. So you're kind of forcing yourself in that that upward spiral. And the other thing there is if you have something that is web-based, or a business that has, let me start the sentence differently. So OpenQuery sells training and consulting subscriptions, training days and consulting subscriptions. I am essentially a salesperson in the business, but that's not what I usually do. The product really mainly sells itself. But what I've optimized is the way that people can buy things. They can just buy this online. They can actually use a form on the website to actually order either training or consulting. And after that, there's some manual processing involved in the invoicing, but that could be automated, obviously, like a web store. And after the invoice is sent, they can actually pay online using credit card, and they can just electronic fund transfer, things like that. So there's steps that I haven't automated, but that actually could be automated really easily. There's nothing fundamental in my business process that requires me to do a lot of work. So I don't have the overhead of a salesperson or administration selling things. And that can work really well for other businesses. If you have a way to sell something online, you're significantly reducing the cost of sale. And that might mean you can sell your product for a lower price. Now, the previous speaker was saying trying to sell for the lowest possible cost may not work for your business. I partially agree with that. You still want to provide some value, and in some cases, people regard something that's more expensive as more value. But I really try to be cheap, in some cases too cheap. The reason is that the moment I, well, I've mentioned this before, the moment I start raising my prices just a little bit, or the moment I decide to launch a new product at a higher price point, I start addressing a different market. I may not be so familiar with that particular market, right? I know a certain market. The moment I start moving up market, I have to learn new things again. Learning costs money. For a while, I'll have less money, which is not necessarily good. I'd like to pay the rent and everything. And by the way, Open Career has been profitable pretty much from day one, which amazed me. And is still profitable, and the bank owes me money rather than the other way around, so that works rather nicely. My laptop, on the last day of my holiday, I came back from Europe last week. Last day of my holiday, my laptop made funny noises and smelly things happened. Literally, burnt electronic smell. So this is actually a new laptop. I just went online to the Apple Store, ordered a new laptop, and there it is. I might still get the other one fixed, but I didn't have time to actually carry it in and wait for that. So I got a new one. I can afford that. It's not my favorite pastime buying new hardware all the time, but I can do it, and I actually don't lose a single minute of sleep over it. I don't stress over the, I don't know, $1,500, $2,000 that it costs. So that, I think for me, that's a very comfortable space to be in. So with that price point, so I sell both the consulting and the training really cheaply, as it makes things really easy to explain for my potential clients. In many cases, the amount of money they're spending is below the threshold that they need to do a lot of internal paperwork. Many companies have a policy, if you're spending more than X amount of money, which can be $500 or $1,000 or $5,000, but if it's lower than that, they can just make the decision on their own. If it's higher than that, it goes through the big process. So by sitting below that, I actually just expedite things and make people happier faster, and I get more clients, because potentially once things go into the process, there's a very large opportunity for things to never happen, or for the sale to be lower because there's more fuss and that kind of thing. So by being cheaper, I actually allow myself to get more customers. In some cases, I get the complaint that I'm too cheap. I'll just live with that. I think that's a bit of a trade-off. It might depend on what you're offering, the kind of business that you run, but it works for me so far. So in terms of consulting, I'm definitely too cheap. That's okay. The cool thing is, though, that with the economics as they are now, my cheapness may actually become a big asset, because other businesses who've geared themselves to providing something at a nice price point that are really regarded as excellent value, but of course it costs, they will now be regarded as, well, we know you're good, but we can't afford you. And then the business has to lower their price. That may cause a problem. Their cost structure may not allow them to lower their price. And my cost structure is such that I don't have to lower my price. My price is good to begin with, and my cost structure works in that space. So who here has ever lowered prices fundamentally, rather than just discounting temporarily?
I had to lower price for one of my clients, because otherwise I wouldn't have got the work.
Exactly. How does that make you feel, and how did that work with the client?
It was interesting, because what the client was saying to me, well, look, for example, my standard rate for IT, which is still very cheap, my standard rate was $40 an hour. Adelaide's standard rate is between $80 to $120 an hour, going right, when they did a survey back a little while ago. I said to him, because he's going to have regular work done, look, I can give you a discount, because he wasn't prepared to pay. He said, I'm not going to pay professional prices to do desktop support. I said, well, whatever. I said, because I also work as a bus driver for this particular guy as well. So there's a bit of a sort of a clique for you coming in here. And so I dropped the price to $30 an hour. And I thought, well, that seems fair. Going from 40 to 30, you know, seeing they're going to give me. He still wasn't happy with that. He said to me, well, he said, I'll give you more work if you drop your price. So I went to $25 an hour. still wasn't happy with it. Went to $21 an hour and we settled. I said ex-GST. And then recently I've been able to get a price raise from $21 an hour ex-GST to $26 an hour ex-GST.
But you're still providing nearly 50% discount.
Yeah, which in my mind is I'm trying to push his price up so that I don't have to provide any more than about, you know, a 35% discount in time. Because it's just, you know, as a small business myself, I'm an operator. You just can't afford to do it.
Yeah, but it's interesting though, because first of all, I think giving something...
I mean, he has actually honoured and given me more work, so I can't complain because he's one of my biggest clients again, so it has worked.
Yeah, but it's more work at a lower price. Now, could you have gotten more work from other clients? Because that would have been...
I struggled to get work, so therefore I just grabbed it.
Yeah, so it's a necessity. You need to make use of that by getting a very, very significant discount.
Obviously desperate for work, so I just... Used it in the wrong
I'm afraid you're getting kind of stuck because the chance of you ever getting back to the original price point with him are just about zero. He's still going to pay more because he knows he can wrangle you for it.
Yeah, I mean, he realised, oh, I've got to price up because the cost of living, everything's going up.
Yeah.
I mean, I had my price set at $40 ex-GST for the last three consecutive financial years, and I said, look, I've got to go up to $50 an hour now because I can't stay at this rate any longer because the cost of everything's going up. So, and all the costs of the business is everything. You know, all the stationary costs, everything's through the roof.
Yeah. I'd like to move on, but I think it's kind of self-descriptive. You really don't want to lower your cost if you can possibly avoid it. Because it's a very nasty path to go, and then you have to negotiate your way up again, which essentially is what gets little begging, and you've already put yourself in a disadvantage because you first discount and then you want your money back again. That becomes very problematic. So staying at a reasonable price point to begin with and just sticking with it. I tend to not negotiate on price. I've also not been asked to negotiate on price. It saves a heck of a lot of time and effort on both sides. We don't need to insult each other with elaborate stories on how we cannot afford something or how this costs so much and scrap that. It's a nice game. I mean, I've been to Istanbul and I've haggled for stuff, and it's an excellent pastime. But I'm a business IT geek. It's not the same thing. This is not Istanbul markets. It's IT stuff. So that's my cost structure. I try to keep my cost low, not just for sales. I don't have an office. I have people contracting for me, and they generally work from home. I have a home office as well. This means that with the economic downturn, my fixed costs are actually extremely low still. My business phone number is a VoIP phone number. If a voicemail gets left, I get an email. If I get a fax, I get a PDF email. I don't actually have a physical fax phone number. It's a fax subscription service that just sends me that email. I do have a multifunction printer at home that can send faxes and will use that same ID, but it's not attached to the same line. There is no phone line that I have that has that phone number, just as an idea. So my office is essentially here. This is my office. It just needs a roof, which it has here. It could be a tent. It really doesn't matter. But the point is, I don't have high costs of paying for an office every month. And at some point, of course, with the economic downturn, if a real estate agent can get away with it, they'll try to raise it. If they think you might walk and they can't get anyone else, then they won't raise it. But usually things do go up. I just don't have that negotiation problem. I don't have that cost, which means I float on happily with my business. So that's the cost structure. Let's try marketing. We've already dealt a bit with sales. So what have different people in the room here done in terms of marketing? How do you promote your product or service? What would you what strategy would you use?
Social media.
Run
events.
Yeah.
Run events to get the right audience.
Ah, yes. Run events to get the right. That's not everybody's thing, of course. We know. Yes, that's not the typical way, but it's a very effective way, of course. Well, if you can actually get it together, that's really, really cool, I know, yeah. So, someone in the back there? No? Yes? Anyone else?
going, you know, going to conferences, you know, meeting people, word of mouth.
Speaking, yes.
You know, stuff like that.
Yeah, absolutely. But again, that's not everybody's thing. What I find with conferences is that actually, unless you're a speaker, you will have significantly less opportunity to interact with people.
I guess, I mean, it depends, I guess, on what you're doing. Like,
yes.
like my thing, I sell software to a very niche little market, which has very specific conferences. You go there, you meet everybody involved in that. So.
Do you find that that is still effective even if you're not a speaker at that conference?
Yes, absolutely.
Okay.
So just to be there and actually have all those people.
It's place. Just an opportunity to get them in the same room.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah, exactly.
Okay,
well,
that's really cool.
Google AdWords campaigns?
Yeah, sure. I do use that. I found that it doesn't actually create significant revenue for me, but it spreads my name a bit wider, because the more often your name pops up in different spaces, the more chance you have of actually people connecting with you. That's an existing marketing.
And it doesn't have to be hugely expensive. Right?
Exactly. That's the thing. I know that if I put a heck of a lot more time into it, and possibly more money, I could make it the conversion rate higher. At the moment, it doesn't have that objective. I could possibly do that in the future. But then there's the problem of cost of sale, and there's overhead involved in that. So at the moment, I use it as one of the ways that people see my name pop up when they browse other stuff. It's in the corner of their eye. They might not actually realize they're seeing it, but it's a mention of Open Careers. So you have done it again. So contractors and employees. How many of you use contractors and how many of you use employees, and how have you made that decision? Anyone want to tell on that? Yeah.
We're contractors, but I mean, we're growing to the point of maybe taking on employees at some stage, but
yep.
Ultimately we use contractors for all the stuff that, you know, when jobs come up, they're too big for us to actually deal with just ourselves. And,
yep.
It's good, and it's also good for testing business relationships. You take on a company person, and then that might build into
Yeah. So you see contracting as a step towards possibly hiring someone, or at least scaling your business now.
Mm. Or establishing strong partnerships between companies that
yes.
Work.
Yeah. So I've done a similar thing. I'm contracting people at the moment. I'm not actually employing anyone but me. And I didn't have a choice with me, obviously. So I'm full time, and other people are not. What I've done though. But that's specific to my business. I contract people for a minimum and a maximum number of hours that they guarantee to be available to me. So they always get paid for the minimum number of hours. They will get paid the agreed rate for the maximum number of hours. If there is more work than that, that's a thing we have to discuss in terms of the pricing at the time. And it depends all on the work in that case. So setting a price for that is a bit unfair to the contractor. Anyway, it has to be discussed, but I can't expect them to be available because they haven't actually contractually committed to being available. They might have other things to do. And I actually use that at the moment specifically because in my space with my scope consulting, it's good for people to also have other things to do. In some cases, they are, for instance, independent web developers, which means they actually gain a lot of experience doing that rather than just dealing with my clients. So it's like a lecturer at university. It would be nice if they actually got out in the real world sometimes. I make sure that they do by not actually getting them in full time. So I also contact trainers, and yes, they also have another business as well, so they're only training part-time with me. I do make sure that they're competent as trainers as well as in the knowledge space that they're teaching me. But so I try to space that out a bit. And by setting a minimum and maximum number of hours, it scales for me, so I know exactly how many hours I have available all the time. And if I need more people, then I can actually get more people and, for instance, give some people fewer hours for a while to actually get their extra person up to speed. I get more customers along the way, and it all builds up. At some point, I fully envisage employing some people, and I still hope that they'll be doing multiple things, but my business will be doing more things most of the time at that stage, so they can actually be diverse enough to actually gain the skills and keep the skills that they have. Monty wants to say.
I just want to point out that for contractor employees, if you're very good, working in a virtual environment,
yes,
they are basically the same if you want and that's what we did in my scale.
Yes.
Practically, you employ somebody in a country, just use and use this contract. The cost structure is totally different. And it just, for me, it's just a question about what are the benefits that you give. In my scale, we always try to give the same benefits to full-time contractors.
But that's a full-time contractor, yes.
Yeah, but I think that you're actually talking about part-time employees and not actually contractors. Because in some, in which environment, employees and contractors are the same.
Oh yes, certainly. I mean, in my case, it is a virtual environment because they do work from home or independently. They don't come into a office or the office to do what they need to do. But regardless, they're all part-time. I don't employ anyone but me at the moment, but more than half their time. And that will remain the case for, I don't know, at least this year. Our business predictions are a bit off, as we've already established, so I don't know. Might be 6 months, I don't know. We'll see. Partnerships, Peter already mentioned them. They're really, really important, but sometimes they really, really don't work. I've had effective partnerships with businesses, and I also have very effective non-partnerships with businesses, let's put it that way. The only example I can give at the moment is one that comes with Sun Microsystems, or specifically the MySQL part in there. So everybody knows I've worked for MySQL, and I know a bit about it. I can't actually be a MySQL partner, and I'll explain why. The partnership program requires that I promote the MySQL Enterprise subscription model. Well, I could do that even though on most levels it actually competes with my own offering. So I'd have to plug that before other things. Bit problematic with my business model. I'd have to plug two competing things. Now, given my price point, it makes me look very affordable, so that could be good. The other thing is this. It requires me to plug the MySQL Enterprise server, which is a specific build of MySQL Enterprise of MySQL Server that comes with the Enterprise subscription, and not specifically discuss the MySQL Community Edition. That's a real problem because of the space that I operate in the MySQL community. So if I want to actually adhere to the rules of the partnership agreement, I can't. I either completely have to change my business, or I can't be a partner. So even though I'm well known in the MySQL space, I can't be a MySQL partner. And MySQL is aware of this, but it works for a majority of the partners, so they're not going to change it for me, which is perfectly fine, but that's the why. And I'm using this as an example, because in some cases, I know people that would like to partner with another business, but it requires them to make significant changes to their business model. And the question I would ask is, do you really want to? Is that really, really worth it? There might be a good name, there might be a good connection with good contacts, but is it really worth it? In some cases, the answer might be yes, in some cases, it might be no. Yes, a couple of minutes, yep. So, last thing I'd like to cover here, I think I've covered most other things, is development model. Who here has dealt with patents and things like that? Yeah, at least only one, that's good. I have dealt with clients that have spent a significant amount of time on protecting their IP and lawyers and that kind of thing. And in some cases it has made sense, but generally they've only done it because they were talking with venture capital as well, and that's just something that the VC asked for rather than actually needing it as well. It's just they're protecting their butts as well. So it's kind of a waste on top of a waste there, from my perspective. What I tend to go for is time to market. Anything that distracts you from getting something from you to your client is wrong, as a premise. Then you can look at specific details, but spending time on patents or spending time on making your product do everything you could possibly want is probably a waste of time. If you can get it out to your client now, that would be much better. So who here has an idea and they think it's unique? No. Not even you.
Actually, it's an very unique idea.
Oh, okay.
Doing all the many of them just now.
Okay, yeah. But the thing is, your idea is not as unique as you think, of course, because there's three other people on the planet who might have the same idea. They might not be able to get it out as quickly or something like that, but it tends to be the case that when you have a good idea, there's at least a couple of other people. The delusion that you're the brightest person on the planet and no one else could possibly have thought of this tends to not work. I sometimes have cool ideas, but usually other people do come up with similar things.
It's not a question about the idea, it's a question about the implement.
Yeah, exactly. That's the speed and the effectiveness.
And that actually becomes a unique idea because you need to see it thoroughly,
yes.
Not only part of it.
Yes. And you have the experience on how to get a good idea into something practical and to market quickly using those models. By the way, that's Monty Vidadius. He originally wrote MySQL, so he's got a bit of a track record in actually making something that doesn't do everything for everybody, but it's damn good and does the job for a lot of people, and that has proven very successful, obviously. It made me some money in the end when it was sold to some. I was, even though I was an employee, in the end, because I joined really early, I actually made 20 times what I put in. Well, what I didn't actually put in. I got options at some point, and the cost of those options was paid back to me by Jonathan Schwartz 20 times. So it was pretty cool. So that was a good VC investment that I never made. That was quite nice. I think we're about at the end of the talk, which put me to that slide. Those are the books that I tend to run by, as they provide some very interesting stories on how to actually make business with, first of all, no money for startups. Presume you don't have any funding. How do you need to look at things differently to actually make things work? And I'd be happy to talk to anyone who comes up to me. Last questions, I'll take one or two and then should finish, I believe. One?
One or two.
One or two is good. Okay, anyone? And otherwise it has to be private, more private talk. You can ask publicly now.
We're about to have morning tea, so you can feel free
to
ask any questions.
Yeah, no questions. Okay, thank you very much.